I look directly into the camera and not at you, which you're here, and the sound comes into my ear, and I don't, so I'm used to this, like not looking at you. In fact, it's better for me not to look at the screen, because especially when live is going on, I don't want to get distracted by comments on YouTube.
Yeah, well, we're kind of here to talk about that today, because Esha, welcome to the show. I've been wanting to invite you on for a long time. We've been mutuals for a while. You run historically a podcast. You're a unrepentant defender of the USSR and a deep. You're like, I don't know how to describe it. You're like a. I use this term. I use this term like honorably. You're like an info jihadi, like at the best. you wage info war, and I guess I do too. I guess like that's what this is. But
yeah,
you know, we laugh at Alex Jones and stuff and whatever. He's like a gorilla, but the term info war,
and I have my Lenin cup right here.
Yeah, exactly.
That I'm making, drinking tea from. And oh, by the way, so in this Lenin cup here, let me see if I can zoom it in. He says, "Uchitsa, uchitsa, I yashoraz uchitsa," which means study, study, and study again.
Well, this is definitely going to not be a study podcast, because I feel like you and I are like Power Rangers of ADHD, and now we're going to like unite our Power Ranger, our like mental neurodivergency, and we're going to like throw each other off our tracks. But it's okay. We have no
okay. Well, Lenin we no also had. I'm 900% sure Lenin had very severe ADHD, because there are so there's the hyper focus. The hyper focus is him getting really obsessed with Karl Kautsky to the point where he wrote 3 books about him. And then there is the inability to control the impulsivity. Like he once wrote a letter to this random dude in this village of Zlobin, asking him to return somebody's bicycle when he was the leader of the country. You'd think he'd have better things to do, but he didn't. So there's a lot of And he once was arguing, so once there was this lady who was wrong on the train, and it was still illegal for Lenin to be in Russia. But he literally like ran out and started to argue with some lady on the train. And the Bolsheviks were afraid that he'd get caught because she looked a little suspicious. And then she luckily gets out in Poland. But yeah, so Lenin, I swear, had very severe ADHD.
Well, this topic might come up because the way I was trying to sort of think about this is like, first, let's talk about like, I don't know. I kind of want to make this a kind of podcaster to podcaster conversation. I know that sounds like really obscenely obnoxious and self-absorbent, but sometimes, you know, like, and I messaged you about this, like, why, like, I want to sort of ask, like, what does it mean to sort of like be in the Imperial Corps? And not that you're there now, you're in a different part of the world than me. You're in Russia right now. But what does it mean for us to sort of work in the Imperial Corps and sort of Anglophone where the hegemony of imperialist discourse has reigned undisturbed for centuries, and it's probably like reigning harder than ever before, if only because like these imperial sort of modes are collapsing so rapidly. Like the mere American imperial power is dwindling. I think that goes without saying. And so I think that at this point there's an interesting conversation to be had about what does it mean to sort of do info war and be a kind of like pugilist the way you are. And
I don't know what the word pugilist means.
Pugilist means fighter. It's a fancy word for fighter. Like you like to fight. I see you on.
It helps me relax. I do it because it personally helps me to relax. I don't suggest other people do it.
This is, but I you know, because I've watched you on Twitter for a long time, and I can see how you know you like to goad the people who come at you, which are many. You know, I'm, you know, surprised. Some people might be surprised to hear this, but I'm not like a confrontational guy. Like I flee from confrontation like a like a good honorary white academic. Like I flee from it. I want nothing to do with it. But like you seem to embrace it and bring it on. And I wanted to sort of begin with, you know, understanding your background. I know you're trained as a lawyer.
Yeah.
And a kind of critical reader, but where, like, your background is not Russian. You're not like, you're
I'm
not
Indian.
This is, yeah, you came into this stuff as an amateur, and now you find yourself like one of the biggest sort of like, I mean, I use this term lovingly because I am one too, but a kind
tanky
of tanky
account.
Mouthpiece.
Yeah.
like we're tankies, like proud and loving it.
Well,
like
it's
that.
Because so I came here when I started historically, I was going to be fact based and. I would only I also promised my audience I'd only use original sources, and I would just tell them the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And as Michael Parenti says, reality has a Marxist bent. So the more facts you learn, the more you learn about the way the world works, it'll like always take you there if you're always connected to reality. So that's what happened to me.
So you studied law, though. And came into this through, and I'm curious, I mean, I did a PhD in comparative literature, and, you know, these two disciplines both involve kind of close reading and analysis and synthesis and ultimately argument and making the case for something, right? Like argumentation and rhetoric, right? Like a lot of the similar tools. Now, one is much more sort of like inflected in the art of like confrontation.
Yeah, the critical reading really helps because what you notice is that a lot of times if you listen carefully, people do tell everything that they're up to. You just have to listen carefully. For example, Hillary Clinton would never say, "I support Medicare for all." She'd say, "I support affordable access to health care." And then when you hear the word access, you realize that they're trying to lower the expectations. So that part of like listening to their words and trying to really understand what these words mean is like a very big step forward.
So when you studied law, what was your original plan?
I didn't have, I guess I wanted to be a lawyer who did good. And that was really hard with all the, like all the school loans and just the path of least resistance doesn't like allow you to do good. You're never going to be a lawyer for the, unless you're Steven Danziger, you're not going to be a lawyer for like Ecuadorian farmers. You're going to be working on the side of ExxonMobil trying to like bury the Ecuadorian farmers in paperwork. Like that's just the path of least resistance. And I didn't really, there's a lot of things that I didn't like about it, like the billable hours. On top of it, I was starting to get put into this government relations, which is like just disgusting lobbying. And that's when I decided, hey, I should switch to academia. And I took a fellowship and I went to Australia and studied law and economics a little bit over there in RMIT. And then I came back and that was right in time for the Bernie campaign. And I was very, very involved. And then I started working for other elected candidates. And then I realized that what I was doing when I was working for other elected candidates was sending a long email every week about some topical issue, maybe something like kind of like historical. And then people would send money, not because they thought the candidate would win, but they enjoyed reading this informational email. And that's when the light went on and like, hey, I should just start a podcast because now I have all these email addresses.
What? It was like 2017 or 18?
18 is when
yeah,
I started.
Yeah, we started our show. Yeah, we started our show around the same time. I feel like there was a moment. And it was connected to the hype around Bernie in a sense, if only because that's where a certain. Yeah, I mean, I live in Canada. I was living in the U.S. at the time, though. I was living in L.A. And I wasn't, I mean, I was never going to vote. I didn't vote. I never had the right to vote in the U.S. I was a foreign student the whole time. So, and I didn't really care either way. Like, I wasn't really sure if Bernie had much of a chance. I seem to think that a lot of people did, but I noticed that a certain kind of despair set in when it became clear that this all the sort of great white hope of Bernie Sanders like wasn't going to work out, and everybody's sort of like rushing to sort of put their eggs in this basket, specifically like DSA and kind of like align themselves. I feel like that had a lot of ripple effects for people, and it kind of opened doors to people like us to kind of move in and sort of ask people like, okay, there's a whole other world out there of, you know, of what could be called like leftism, you know, which is a term I'm like whatever about, but at the same time, like that I feel like there was a critical juncture sometime in the second half of the 2010s and it opened up things for people like us. Or maybe I'm wrong.
I think it did a little bit. So it at least got people to the idea that you need an Okay, so the first thing it did is a lot of the U.S. media has always been the same since time immemorial. But it's hard to notice that if you're not deeply involved in a situation. So when you read about, like, the New York Times writing, why warlords in Afghanistan are good for democracy, or that was Washington Post, I think, or something like that, you might not notice what they're doing, that they're literally an arm of the State Department that just kind of repeats their propaganda over and over. But then with the Bernie and Hillary campaign, since she worked at the State Department, she had all these media contacts, and literally majority of the mainstream media was being used as an arm of the Hillary Clinton campaign. And this is not a conspiracy theory, because we can see it in Podesta leaks, where literally member John Podesta wrote an article, and that article, without being edited, ended up in New York Times. What's her name? Maggie. I can't remember.
Maggie Haberman, yeah.
Yes, that's her. Okay. Anyways, so a lot of people then, that is when they realized that you need your own independent media apparatus, because the mainstream media is not 100% trustworthy. And that's when more people are willing to pay the $5 a month to fund people like you and me.
Well, so that's the question. The funding thing is interesting, because people like us are independent. I mean, we rely upon the people who, like, directly consume our materials.
Please go to historically.net.
Yes, please do so. You should support the people whose content you like. And that's just, like, a fact. And you should just not give your money for 10 years or 15 years, I subscribed to the New York Times. Like, I spent probably over $1,000. I know. I'm embarrassed to admit it.
The worst thing about New York Times is they have advertising. So their main you are the main product. They sell you to their advertisers. Yeah. You are their product. People don't realize that.
I'm so embarrassed. Yes, I didn't. Like, I was a willing sub. I was paying for them to lie to me. And, like, that's what it means to, like, subscribe to the corporate media in any degree. And so, like, when you watch MSNBC, you're, like, paying.
No, you're also the product. You are the product that they're selling. Just remember that. They are selling you to their corporate advertisers. You're the thing they're selling.
Exactly. So I guess the question is, like, in this environment, like, what, like, I can't help but think, what's that quote? Like, it's like, oh God, thy sea is so big and my boat so small. Like, that, I feel like, sums up the sort of task of the anti-imperialist podcaster, that, like, you know, you're taking up these, like, things that are much bigger than us. Like, we are two little people fighting against New York Times, Washington Post, every single,
and the case of it.
But in a sense of, like, there is this something called information war, and we all are subject to it.
Oh,
so,
my,
like,
God.
What your relation to it is one of either passive observer, or, like, someone who ignores it, which is, I think, most people. Or that you have the sort of media class people who are belligerents as part of it, in support of it, right? And the sort of, like, class of people around it, academics who say that, oh, this is a conspiracy theory, blah, blah, blah. Like, there's a kind of small corner of people who boast this stuff, and then a larger group of people who sort of watch this stuff and either like it or just kind of tolerate it. And then there's the majority of people who, like, don't care about...
But then they still imbibe, like, but because they're so passive...
Yes, it is absorbed. Yeah, it is. You do end up, just by osmosis, absorbing so much, like, imperialist, like, fiction about the world. Like, you can't help it. So, like, what do we do? Like, what's the point of this? Like, of what, like, is it just for ourselves? Like, is it just to, like, make ourselves feel better?
So let's go back to Antonio Gramsci. He talked about the idea of manufacture of consent and coercion. So he was the head of the Italian Communist Party. Well, it was back then. I don't think it was called the Social Democrat. I can't remember what his party was called.
I think PCI. Was it the PCI?
Probably. I don't remember. But then he got arrested and got sent to prison for the next 20 years. And literally the prosecutor says that his mind is dangerous and we need to lock it up, is what they literally said. And he was trying to figure out, why do workers who live in imperialist states like Germany and the U.S., whose life is crap, agree to this whole paradigm? And this is where he came up with the idea of manufacture of consent and coercion. So the thing is, what people don't realize is propaganda only works as far as they can construct a reality for the worker where the propaganda makes sense. So in the 1950s, the U.S. can lie and say, oh, capitalism is good because everyone has an equal chance. But that's because in the 1950s in the U.S., they constructed a reality with those suburbs where one salary was enough and people who are working in factories got enough to live off of and blah, blah, blah. In Indonesia, what they needed is death squads that went and murdered people by the millions, because Indonesia, they could not create that reality where you would say capitalism will let everyone have a decent life, because that illiterate Indonesian farmer knows better. So ever since, and Gramsci talked about this, this is the concept of hegemony. Anything that's not used for production, as in like newspaper people, priests, teachers, all these help maintain this kind of like a bubble of reality. And that reality only works if the base is there and if they can construct that reality. You just can't, I can't go and tell you the sky is pink right now, because that is conflicting with what you see with your own two eyes. Anyways, since the fall of the Soviet Union and the US elites really believed in the end of history crap, so they deindustrialized the U.S. And so what happened is that the same propaganda is not going to work on the future generations that worked on the past generations, because their reality has changed. So right after college, they're not getting that one two-car house, whatever, two-car garage, whatever that crap is. What is it? Two-garage house with like...
The two-car garage and the picket fences. Yeah,
that one. They're not getting that. What they're getting is that they're living with their parents and they're barely employed or underemployed. They're settled with college debt. So what you're getting, and nothing is fundamentally changing. So there are more and more people who, for whom the reality does not work. And of course, you could, the problem is, you can, of course, like, they could go to the direction of Alex Jones and like believe that it's all the, I don't, God knows, there are gay frogs or something like in the water. Or we could like give them an actual constructive dialectical explanation that's based on why the world is this way, based on the past 400 years of imperialism followed by industrialization and so on. And what we say will always make sense because it is based on reality. So, but like I said, we wouldn't be able to do it if there was like, if the situation was like the 1950s, because there would not be a critical mass of people for whom the propaganda won't work, because their reality is different than what the propaganda is saying.
So I'm still curious though, like where do you situate yourself in this machine? Like, how do you, like, what makes you go?
Wanting for people to learn a little bit more about the way the world is. One of my most famous articles, it has like over a million views now, I wrote about it. It's called Economy of Evil. And a lot of people, it's basically, I explained how what Hitler and Mussolini's economy was, and it sounds a lot like Ronald Reagan for obvious reasons. So I do it because I hope to like just like throw a little bit of like a, like just so that if you, because this whole reality that in the they've constructed in the West is just a big deck of cards that will just fall apart in like the, with even the slightest bit of scrutiny. So I do it because I think it's the right thing to do. People need to understand when the U.S. is supporting like the Contras or some psychotic death squad that like is bludgeoning babies to death, like the Nicaraguan Contras. They need to kind of also look at past patterns and then look at what's going on in the future. I, of course, understand that just understanding is not enough to change anything, and there needs to be a whole new organization and whatnot that's beyond the scope of what one person can do. But the key to even thinking about such a change is to even to begin to understand.